Hi, welcome to another episode of Jenga Chat. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined today by Will Vincent. Hello, Will Vincent.
Hi, Carlton Gibson.
Hello, Will Vincent. Jenga Chat, what's that you're saying? It's a podcast on the Jenga web framework. Totally out of practice. Welcome back from the summer break, folks. Joined today by Gojo Arisa, who I've just bumped into at JengaCon. He gave a great keynote there, and we're going to talk about some of the topics he brought up there. Hey, Gojo, how are you?
I'm good. How are you all?
Very excited to have you on. You've just flown back from Porto, yeah?
Yeah, yesterday, what is 8 a.m. Tuesday in Central Time as I'm recording this, and I arrived home. I got back to my apartment about 11 p.m. Monday, so.
Wow. Well, you're a trooper. We appreciate it.
No problem.
Thanks for coming on. So let's first of all talk about JengaCon, because it's been, what, 2-3 years since we were all able to get together?
Yeah, definitely. I guess 2019 probably the last time, so. But I can't recall if you two were at JengaCon US 2019.
The US one, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Not Europe, okay. Though.
So yeah, that was the last time, because that was in like September, October time 2019. And then obviously by the time the spring came around, JengaCon Europe was cancelled because of...
but I remember I had my plane ticket, which I had to get a refund and all. I was so excited. Carlton was going to caravan and bring his whole family on the train over, so...
That's right. I keep forgetting Carlton lives in Spain, and so he's, you know, closer to various European things.
I was going to, I ended up flying to Porto this time, just, you know, short-ish flight, but I really wanted to get the train. But like, it's like 3 hours, say, from Barcelona to Madrid, which is kind of halfway across the Iberian Peninsula.
That's such a cool train ride. That's like, I've done that, the high-speed one. It's so beautiful, and that's the fastest in the world, I think.
Well, I don't know. I read a thing recently that said that Spain's got the second largest high-speed network in the world after China, because they've invested a lot of the EU development funds in that. And then, you know, you can get from Madrid to close to the Portuguese border in sort of similar kind of time, but there's just no connections across. And so it was going to take me a couple of days each way. And in the, you know, with my wife taking care of the kids at home, I'm like, I can go away for, you know, the conference and then the sprints and then, but like to stretch it 2 days either side is asking a bit much. So I had to fly. But maybe next time. I mean, if they have it in Paris, I'm definitely getting next. I can get to Paris.
They just announced it's Edinburgh in May, I believe, next year.
Yeah. So JengaCon Europe 2023, Edinburgh in May, end of May. So, I don't know about you, Kojo, but when I first arrived, it was my first in-person event since the pandemic. And so we arrived and we walked into the park where the venue was, and it was an amazing venue. Porto is a lovely city, and there's this big conference center dome arena thing, and it's like, wow, yeah, we definitely needed to make sure that we definitely need to come after they put all the work in to organize it. We definitely needed to come here. This is amazing. But then you get there and it's like, oh, like lots of people, I think nearly 600 people in the venue. And it's like, that was a little strange for me. It's certainly the first day I suddenly got a bit more used.
For me, I guess for better or for worse, this was my third event, in-person event this year. So I keynoted Pi Texas in at the end of March of this year. And so that's like a 2.5 drive in Austin, a 2.5 hour drive from Houston. So pretty straightforward. And I used to live in Austin, so I'm comfortable with the city. But that was, I'm pretty sure under 200 people. It might have been like 125, 150. So it was, you know, but that was my first in-person gathering of, you know, anyone who wasn't like a family member, really, yeah. Since 2019. And so, you know, so that sort of eased me into things a little bit. And then I was also at PyCon US.
This is like 1,000 or something.
Yeah, it was like 1,000 or 1,800. It was not as big as usual PyCon. Maybe like half the number of in-person people as usual PyCon. But still, you know, more than 8,000 people that you don't know, or most of whom you don't know. A very large venue, you know, PyCon is usually in like the city's main convention center. That sort of helped, I guess, with getting over any potential anxieties as far as like suddenly being in a crowd again. But then Porto was different because this is my first time in Europe proper, or mainland Europe, or I still, despite having been there, I still don't know what it's called. It's the European mainland. From having lived in China, I think, you know, the Chinese mainland, the European mainland, I guess, but I doubt that's what people in Europe say. So.
Well, I don't think people in Europe, I think people in Britain, they call it the continent, we're going to the continent.
This is like, what you also say, the queen. That's like
well, we say these days we say the king, you know. We're not talking about that. Let's not. Okay. Go on. If you've got a question, go on.
Do people really say the king now? Like, I mean, like, just like when the year changes, people still writing last year's date on things. It's like it's been like what, 2 weeks? You know, people still saying. You know, I'm sure people are still reflectively saying "God save the queen." And, you know, and then she's Beyonce.
They may well be. To be honest, I don't know.
Carlton fled for a reason. So
exactly.
Civil War, the English Civil War back in the 16, whenever, had to live in Holland until, you know, like John Locke, for instance, John Locke, famous British philosopher, he had to live in exile for a while or something. Anyway,
so,
I don't know.
Yeah, so in-person gatherings, Porto was nice. The getting reaccustomed to being around large numbers of people, you know, was, that part was less of an issue. I think it was just really more the sort of, you know, just the adjustment to new country, new continent. Although it also helped that I was the opening keynote, and so there wasn't really time to be worried about anything other than, okay, you know, do I have words to say? I feel like I have words to say, but can I say those words? Who can know? And then I went and said the words, and then I was tired. And so,
I think the opening keynote is the best spot to have because you can relax, you can just enjoy the conference. Whereas if you're talking at any other spot, it's like builds and builds until you talk, and then you can relax.
Yeah. And I know myself, I will tend to make adjustments. And I guess I sort of saw other people sort of, and I'm not sure if this was scheduling genius on the part of the Django Kendra people or just sort of lucky serendipity, but it seemed like there were, you know, a number of talks that had at least a somewhat related topic to my opening keynote, you know, or the, you know, more than one of us was on the same page, and I heard sort of references to my talk over the course of the event. But then it was also interesting because I know that, like, I'm that person too. Like, if I were speaking later in the event, there's always this temptation to be like, oh, let me include something that I heard in somebody else's talk in my talk. So,
yeah, I think that's one of the lovely things about the live conference versus the pre-recorded talks that we've had the last couple of years. I mean, and the virtual conferences are massively better than no conference at all, but this kind of way that the narrative of the conference builds over the course of the 3 days, and that's super. So we wanted to get you on because I think your keynote was super important and something that, you know, really interesting. And so perhaps you could talk about what was your talk, and, you know.
So the talk, the title was Improving Contributor Experience and Broadening Contributor Scope. It really probably should have been called Improving Maintainer Experience, but sort of both were true. There were two very broad ideas there. One being that in the open source community, we have people who are maintaining the core projects, and we as a community need to try to find ways to better support those people, better support them as they do work that supports us. That's important. And then at the same time, sort of the need to broaden the scope of our contributors, of the different people who contribute to the projects. We have, as a community, I think, focus too much on the idea of contributors being only, contributors being limited to people who write code for, you know, so for, you know, for the people who write code for Django, or people who, you know, who write code for Python or what have you. And the truth is there are a lot of other types of contributions and types of contributors. I never work on a talk because I'm always working on talks. And so I think the next version of this talk, or the next iteration of these ideas, might have to be called, like, let's talk about how we talk. Because as I was working on this talk, you know, and sort of discussing my ideas with other people, issues came up around language, and I had some of my own concerns about, as far as like using certain terms, and trying to not alienate people and trying to not other people, things of that nature. So the idea is, like, even like the small differences between a term like a non-code contributor and a non-coding non-coding contributions. They sound almost identical, but they can have very different meanings depending on one's ear. But I think, and just sort of for the sake of play, since I'm using examples, I have used the term non-code contributor in my talk and in some of the things I've referenced as someone who is a contributor to Python or Django or what have you, but they're contributing by not using code. And in my talk, I used examples of some of my coworkers from RevSys, three of whom are developers, one of whom is not. And so for people who are familiar with the Django community and or Django chat, Jeff Triplett, who does the newsletter with Will and is a former founding member of the Django Events Foundation North America, former DjangoCon US chair and DjangoCon US co-chair, current Python Software Foundation board member, Frank Triplett, former Django Software Foundation president, Lacey Williams-Sencho, who is a former DjangoCon US chair and co-chair and organizer, and then Catherine, who works at RevSys and does a lot of administrative stuff behind the scenes to make sure that DjangoCon US works and has done similar type of work for the DSF. And the reason I use them as examples is because all those contributions that they're doing, they're definitely making significant contributions to Django and the Django community, but none of them involve code. Like three of those people, Jeff, Lacey, and Frank, are developers and are capable of doing code contributions, but they're not. They're making contributions without code. And then Catherine is not a developer at all, but those are all very significant contributions. So I contrast that non-code contribution with a term I've heard other people use and say the idea of like non-coding contributors, which is almost sort of this like, oh, well, people who can't code, and so they have to do other things that people who can't code do because that's all they can do. And it ends up being this sort of like, oh, like the kids table sort of, this is sort of a very weird thing. I think that's why we have to, I think, like I said, the next iteration, this might be, let's talk about how we talk, because there are definitely sort of ideas and cultural norms in our community that I think we need to address and need to be fixed. Prime example, and I was literally shocked to hear this, to sort of hearing witnesses. So I was the opening keynote for this can sound a little pedantic, but the repetition is for a point. I was the opening keynote speaker at DjangoCon Europe, a Django conference full of Django people. The closing keynote for DjangoCon Europe, a Django conference full of DjangoCon people, in front of Django people, was Chaim Kirby, who is the Django Software Foundation's vice president. And I watched him stand on a stage at DjangoCon Europe in front of a bunch of Django people as the Django Software Foundation vice president and say he has never contributed Django. And I'm like, okay, that's, and this is not to try to, be pedantic about his words or what have you, but it's sort of a larger cultural thing of he got on a stage in front of a bunch of Django people and said that and knew that they would, he knew how they would interpret it. And was sort of aware that, okay, well this is sort of the commonly accepted viewpoint in our community. If you have not made a code contribution to Django, then you have made no contributions. You have not contributed to Django. And you look at different people's like bios, and it's like, oh, Django contributor. And I'm like, okay, well, that's someone who's like on the technical board or what have you. And so like we somehow as a community have defined contributor as only people who have written code or maybe docs.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. But what I love is anybody who's involved in Django, involved in the Django community, as soon as you phrase it as clearly and bluntly as that you've got somebody like Jeff or Frank or Lacey or Catherine, or Chaim, and you say they haven't, Frank and Jeff and Lacey have all made commits at some point, but like, you say, oh, they're not contributors. That's ridiculous. And everybody involved in the... And so, okay, it's like reductio ad absurdum. It's like we've got, this the way of using contributors like this leads to conclusions which we all know are false. So it can't be a good way of using it.
And in addition to that, I think it also... So the subject, so kind of cutting my talk in sort of halves or thirds, there was an issue sort of me trying to lay out the problem of why our current maintainers need more help. So the first half to third to two thirds of the talk was focused on code contributions. Because there's a problem that I thought needed to be laid out, and then I proposed a solution to this idea of a new role of contributor mentors, specifically code contributor mentors. But then the second part of the talk, maybe the last third approximately, was focusing on non-code contributors. I've been struggling with that language. Maybe sometimes using contributions without code. Because the people that I work with, in two weeks, I leave for DjangoCon US, where I'm an organizer. I am the orientation chair, the Lightning Talk chair, and the development sprints chair. Like, there's no code involved in that, I think I said this to people in Porto, while we were at DjangoCon Europe, as we were sitting at lunch, there was no code involved in putting those beers on the table, or having the food arrive, or securing the venue, making sure all the AV worked, the large undertakings involved in putting on DjangoCon Europe, or any sort of conference, or all sorts of other things. Those are contributions without code, but those are still vital and necessary. I mean, like, Haim's talk about the future of the DSF and where it can go and what it might do, he wasn't talking about like regression bugs. He wasn't talking about how we need to improve test coverage or update versions of Docker. It's about the legal and the financial and the organizational aspects of the Django Software Foundation and keeping those things going. And so I think those sorts of contributions are often overlooked. And I think because the community culture is too heavily slanted towards software engineering. And also I'm realizing that I need to, I've done a separate talk on this called the Python Spectrum, and this idea that there's a range of people who use Python, but I'm realizing I have like this graphic that's a bidirectional arrow that's meant to show a continuum or a spectrum. Now I'm realizing I may need to change that graphic to make it more visually clear that software engineering is a specific use of programming. So it's like if you've written any code, then you're a programmer. I mean, like if you've written Hello World, that's programming. You're a programmer. Congratulations. You might not think of yourself as a programmer. You might not be someone who programs on a continuous basis. But anyone who's written any sort of code is a programmer. As you move towards the other end of the spectrum, you have this very specialized use of programming, which is what's known as which is what I call software engineering. And that's what people who are, I've got a bunch of different things that delineate that. But when most people think of professional developers, they're usually thinking of software engineering. But especially with Python, that is an increasingly small subset of the community. And so, it came up a few times, but just the idea that software engineering is a subset of programming. So software engineers are a small group of programming, of the people who use programming, specifically Python, for various uses. It's a small subset of people who use Python to generate some value for themselves. But the community culture is so heavily slanted towards software engineering as the one true way that it leads to all these weird things. So.
I think that's right as well. It's because if you just take Django, I think the vast majority of Django projects out there are on the programming to middle end of the spectrum rather than, as you get into a bigger team and a bigger project, you take on more and more software engineering practices. But most of the literature that you read is all about being Google and Facebook and, massive companies. And it's just not appropriate to take on that kind of tooling for the vast majority of Django applications that have ever been written and ever will be written.
Exactly.
I was just going to say, I think part of why there's so much just advanced writing is that people in those organizations have the luxury and the knowledge to write it. So they have an employer and they can spend months on a specific thing and then they want to document it. Whereas a beginner generally doesn't have the confidence or doesn't document what they're learning as much. Or if you're in the middle, I know, I think like going, who goes to conferences, right? It's a lot of consultants, freelance people, and then people at big corps, because it's an investment, right, to do. So I think there's the same thing for tutorials, to write any sort of blog post is a big investment in time. And for whatever reason, I think the more advanced you are, the more prone you are to write that. And, you know, I find this, like, I lose my sense of what a beginner is thinking, except that I get lots of emails every day. That's the only way I have any sort of touch point to remembering all the pain that I went through.
Yeah. And I think, and I'm not sure how clearly I communicated this yet. When it's like the moment you finish your talk, you know, you're like, okay, here are like the 12 ways this could have been better. You know,
yeah.
You're talking, communicating this more clearly. But for me, one of the sort of the danger points there is that by focusing the definition of contributor so heavily on people who make contributions by way of code, we end up largely excluding, you know, or, you know, sort of explicitly, but also sometimes sort of, you know, sort of tacitly or, you know, unconsciously, sort of excluding people who could become contributors, who could become contributors without needing to use code. And so it's like most of what Chaim was talking about in his keynote, like those, we need more of those people. And my contention is, and I think, you know, this is like sort of where Will and I have similar backgrounds as far as having been like, you know, accounting / MBA people before, you know, becoming developers. As I said in my talk, I was professionally trained in capitalism. And so, after, you know, receiving my professional capitalism training, I then became a software engineer. But there are a lot of people in those spaces who could benefit from Python. And that's my first sort of serious Python project was in my work as an accountant and automating a process. But I think there are lots of people who, and the most obvious example of this, we see with the growth of data science, and people, you know, generate all sorts of value with Python and other tools in the realm of data science. But there are a lot of other people who could benefit from both Django and Python without having it become their primary focus. It is this spectacularly useful tool. The language itself lends itself to people being able to focus on solving the problem instead of having to wrestle with the language. And so, you know, and so that's a much larger percentage of the population using Python and Django. And those people who aren't focusing on being web developers or software engineers as their primary career have all these other skills and all this other expertise that we could use in our community, as far as, you know, with ranging sort of from obvious things like the DSF board, the PSF board, but also on, you know, on smaller boards, like, you know, for the, you know, if there's an organization around DragonCon Europe or DEFNA, or like, I know here in Texas, there's a Pi Texas Foundation and, you know, different organizations like that, or organizing your local meetups, or, you know, or helping to solve code-related problems without actually being involved in code. So this contributor mentor thing that I've been thinking about and trying to sort out and talking to Carlton about, some of that is motivated by my desire to help friends who are, you know, maintainers of projects, but that is also work that needs to be done, an issue that needs to be sort of figured out to some extent. But the core maintainers shouldn't necessarily be the ones trying to figure that out, because they're already using a lot of their free time. And again, most of the people are, you know, using their free time not spent with their families, time not spent taking a nap or eating a pie or going on a walk. They're building software for us. And so instead of also asking them to figure, it's like, oh, you have problems? Well, use some more of your free time to figure those out. You know, there are other people who could be trying to figure out, you know, decent solutions to those problems, but those are also contributions that don't involve code.
Carlton, you and I have mentioned at one point, or you mentioned the idea of like a hall of fame or some sort of, you know, recognition for all these people, because I think part of, and I don't think you mentioned this yet, Kojo, but part of the issue is that a commit is so black and white and there forever, but organizing a conference or all these other things, you know, people aren't doing it necessarily for the recognition, but it's harder to see it, whereas a commit you see.
Well, I think this, I mean, it, this is like a long-standing sort of discussion that we've been having. It goes back to the discussions 3-4 years ago around the dissolution of the old Django core, which became Django Dept 10 and changed the governance of Django. And it's kind of natural when you begin a software project, and it's, you know, only a few people in Lawrence, Texas, to count the commits.
Kansas. Right?
Because, sorry, Lawrence, Kansas. Yeah. I apologize to my my southern middle bit of the North American listeners that I got the states wrong.
They're very proud in Kansas, so I just, yeah.
Yeah, so I as well. They rightly should be. I'd like to go to Kansas. But it's natural you count the commits. But then as the community grows, and especially it grows to something like Django's side, that all these other aspects come in, and it's how do you count those? It's... And you know, one hope that there was around the end of the dissolution of the old Django core and this kind of honorary title of a Django core contributor was that we would be able to apply it more widely. And I think the ball was nicely picking up momentum there, and ideas and lists of, you know, some cohorts that could be applied to were being drawn up. And then obviously the pandemic arrived and, well, that ground to a halt. But I think that that's... picking up, Katie McLaughlin was helping me pull together a, hopefully we're going to get a list of, you know, be able to draw together contributors for Django, perhaps 4.2, we'll get it up and running. I tried to do it for Django 4.0, and then the world came along and sort of knocked me sideways just at the wrong moment. So that didn't happen. I got a couple of blog posts that identified some committers. But again, this was just committers. What Katie's able to do, I mean, and she's given many talks on this subject and works
it's doing a lot of, again, this is a contribution that doesn't require code. And I mean, there could be some code in the background, but it's not a direct, it is not a contribution of code to Django or to Python, but it is a contribution to those larger ecosystems. And I know she has done a lot of work around this idea of sort of better highlighting and better surfacing and better tracking people who make contributions without code.
Yeah, and what she's able to do is she's got tooling around this to do this. It's not only get the person who made the commit, like the official person with the GitHub commit, but any co-authors, and then she's able to go to the issues and find people who commented and interacted and gave a meaningful interaction. Because, you know, you might advise everybody and yet not commit anything. And, you know, not, and somehow you were a major part of the release, and yet you weren't recognized at all. And this isn't, you know, I hope she's making massive progress there. So hopefully that will come together, or, you know, or it will come together. It's just, you know, when it comes together for which particular release. But then that should give us the center for saying, well, okay, but also in this time period, you know, this conference was organized. Who were the team there, and then start to call those people out and recognize them and say, hey, that was important. And then, you know, who was on the Django Software Foundation board? Well, and what did they do? And then we can start to say, well, you know, in your city, who organized the meetups? And we can just start to build a wider recognition culture. And the thing with recognition is that you can identify the jobs that are done. You can then give recognition for them. But you can then start to codify what the job actually is. Because, do you realize the Django translation team, who are never recognized by anybody in the whole 17 years of the history of translations in Django, that, you know, that they do all this, and that one day they might not turn up for work for whatever reason, and rightly so. And because I say work, it's not paid. It's all volunteer for all of this time. What work is it they do? And so if we do need to give them more support, and we do need to make sure that there are other people around who know what that work is, that we can draw up a sort of a checklist of what the work is, and then a call for volunteers to help do it. It's a kind of self who can then go on to be recognized, right? It's a self-perpetuating cycle for a healthy community, a healthy ecosystem.
Yeah, I think so. And with, let's see. So one of the bits of information that I referenced to in my JangoCon Europe, you know, there was, you know, I was sort of synthesizing ideas from different places, but one of them that I felt was very important to include was Naomi Cedar's PyCon US 2022 keynote, where she talks about, you know, sort of the idea of our community being a gift economy, or, you know, sort of a gift-based ecosystem. And I think that is important from the standpoint of one of the problems that has come up, in much the same way that, like, you don't want to build your community around responses to, you know, a limited number of bad actors. Like this one guy tried to put a bomb in his shoe on a plane, and now we all have to take our shoes off forever at the airports. So you don't want to sort of, you know, to key in on that too much. But I think Naomi's points as far as wanting our community to remain the sort of gift economy, and the not just a transactional thing, is important. And you will sometimes have bad actors as far as, you know, code-related contributions, who will try to make a code-related contribution just so they can sort of say, ooh, look what I did, or have a line item on the resume. So, and that is a concern. And so I agree with Naomi that we want to keep things focused on you know, as close to a gift economy as we can. However, and I bring that up because sometimes when you start talking about recognition, there's a concern that, oh, well, people will start, if there's more recognition, people will start doing stuff for recognition.
They gain the system.
I think that is, while technically true, you know, and theoretically possible, I don't think that that's a large concern. I think the larger issue is that by recognizing, by increasing the recognition of these people who are making contributions, you know, that don't require code, it also allows you to highlight the areas of need within your community or your project. It's like, okay, we have, you know, so let's say you can, over the course of a 6-month period, you can see 100 commits to Python, CPython, 100 commits to Django. Okay, those are clear and obvious, you can see those. They're easy to look at, it's data that's easy to capture. But then if you can look over and see, oh, well, wait a minute, we have like 200 people who are making these contributions that don't require code. Okay, well, like, clearly that stuff that was done and needed to be done, like what is that stuff and who's doing it and how can we make sure that it continues to happen? Because like yes. Nobody, you know, we definitely try to make sure that the new code contributions continue to happen. And we have tooling around that. But okay, well, what's this other stuff that has happened, that's going on and that makes things work? And that people, you know, what's this work that people are doing? But we need to make sure we're aware of that, and so that we can continue to have that work being done, and try to improve the way it's done, and make the lives of those people easier, and make the lives of future non-code contributors easier.
Well, maybe this has come up before, Carlton, but I mean, even just having a / contributors page on Django project, I mean, for some of this, I mean, we don't list past board members, right? Like, I've, based on this podcast, some former board members have reached out and been like, oh yeah, we wrestled with that issue before. And I didn't know they were on the board because there's no listing anywhere. Same with translation team, right? Like actually quite often there's emails into the DSF board saying, how do I, you know, help? And so redirect them to, used to be the Google group, now the forum, but it's completely hidden. So just in terms of like doing something, right? Like, you know, the first step is, okay, even if we had past board members, DjangoCon organizers, translation team, there's many, many more people to add, but you sort of need to start somewhere, I think, rather than not do anything.
You can't not do any of this because you can't recognize everybody. You have to start recognizing someone.
We have a Google Doc somewhere with like 200 people with like former core. I forget what happened. It's like sort of dried out a little bit. There was, I mean, it would be a lot of people, but I think if you had like current, we could delineate, as you both been saying, you know, conferences, organizing, helping, mentoring, you know, however we define it, and then also have, you know, scroll down to the bottom past ones, and then it can be a little bit on people to add themselves. But
I mean, and we, Katie said something I felt important at the conference while we were discussing this. She said to me that, look, if we can just focus on recognizing some people from, say, a fixed release, say the next release coming up.
Yeah, exactly.
And then if we can then run it for backdating, well, that's great. But, you know, if we can do it for one release and then do it going forward, that's better than worrying, well, you know, did we really capture everyone in the whole history of Django?
It's not as relevant.
The fact we haven't been able to do that. Well, it'd be nice to do, but don't be blocked by it.
No, exactly.
From even starting.
You don't want the lack of a perfect solution for everyone to stop you from trying to attempt to iterate on a first solution that you can then, you know, improve on going forward.
Yeah. I've got a question about a term that you brought up a couple of times, but it'd be nice to just sort of clarify it a bit for the listeners who weren't at the keyword, which is contributor mentors. And the reason why, let me bring it in the way that it appeals to me, is because for quite a few years I've been worried about the on-ramp to contributing to Django, and I've narrowly thought more about code contributors, but I think it would apply across the board. But it can be difficult to get going to, you know, contributing. It's you know, Django is not now a project where there are really low hanging fruit, which you come along, snip off, and you've contributed a major new feature. And as you said, as like, you know, as a Django fellow, part of my role is to help get people on board and to help new contributors. But there's only so much time that I can allocate to that. So in that space, could you just say a little bit more about the contributor mentors and, you know?
And I guess let me sort of be clear here. So this idea of contributor mentors is, I'm not the first person to think of this, but I'm using sort of my own terminology here, in my own very limited, you know, partially big thinking on this. But the idea being, what we currently have is, you know, with Django and with Python and with most other open source projects, we have like the core maintainers who have like that primary responsibility of making sure the next version of Django or the next version of Python gets, you know, released, is in good working order and gets built and gets released so that the world can use it. And that's their primary responsibility. That is, you know, the primary burden that rests on them. When you have, as an open source project, you have, you know, new people who want to sort of make contributions for various reasons. And the issue then is the only people to really sort of help those new potential contributors are the core maintainers who are already doing, in most cases, a lot of volunteer work on their own to make sure that we get new Django, new Python, that PyPI keeps working, blah, blah, blah. And so that A puts an increased burden on our current maintainers, which increases the risk of them burning out, which is not good for any of us. But then B, it also makes the experience of trying to sort of sort out how to contribute to the project, i.e. how to help all the rest of us for free, it makes that process more difficult, you know? And so like, if you want people to help you for free, you want to try to figure out the easiest way to have those people, you know, show up and help you for free. And so my idea of a code contributor is to sort of have, if you try to look at it visually, you have, you know, at one level you have the core maintainers, and like they have the primary responsibility of making sure that, you know, the software, you know, is in good working order, gets released. And then you have lots of new people sort of coming in and trying to interact with them to make contributions. This idea of a contributor mentor is someone, is a set of people who are sort of between those two groups, and who is, A, can have a focus on helping new people get started, so that the primary maintainers of project, and again, focusing on this is on a software side, make sure that the primary maintainers or the core maintainers, or, you know, they call it different projects, make sure the core maintainers aren't having to, you know, to focus as much of their energy on that, because they have this primary responsibility of getting the software out. So they can help new people get onboarded and figure out how to make contributions and what to do, and maybe also sort of, you know, help with some triaging of tickets and things of that nature. The specifics will vary from project to project, but essentially sort of acting as a buffer between the primary project maintainers and like new active or new potential contributors. I think that the new potential contributors part is important, because, you know, there are people who will be excited about open source and want to show up and make a contribution, and then maybe sort of once they've done it once, they've done it once and that, now they're fine, and they'll go off and might not ever come back, might come back 3 years later, you know, what have you. But to have the core maintainers have to divert a lot of their attention to all these people who in many cases are transient, attention is a limited resource. And the core maintainers of any project, as human beings, have limited attention. On a related but slightly, you know, tangential philosophical rant, one of the reasons so many people are distracted today is because we have these little attention-stealing devices in our pockets all the time.
Children, right? That's what they are, children. Because I got it.
If it was just children, that would be a different thing. But even the smallest child won't fit in your pocket, and so. You know, and then the trick is like the children also have these little devices in their pockets as well. And so now, you have three kids, each kid has a detention distracting stealing device, and you have one of your own. So it's turtles all the way down. But and so at this point, so large corporations have focused on monetizing attention. That's how important and valuable the resource attention is. And we have our project maintainers who, you know, who again, as human beings, have a limited amount of attention. And so trying to give them back some of their attention while also providing additional attention to people who want to contribute, again, to people who want to come and help us for free. And so, you know, let us provide attention to those people who want to come and help make sure that their new version of Django and their new version of the pipeline, and to try to help make that process as easy as possible. And so the reason it's sort of a bit half-baked is, yeah, I'm still trying to sort out the details of it. And so my experiment will be to try to make myself a contributor mentor for Django, and then try to, again, back to what we were talking about as far as trying to recognize people who are contributing without code. Instead of trying to come up with a perfect solution, maybe try it for one Django release and then you know, you can iterate on that going forward. That's the approach I'm going to take with this contributor mentor thing. So try to figure out what can I do and you know, can I put myself in this role that I have in my mind and then iterate on that.
Just thinking about one concrete way we can to try this out, and you're Sprint's chair for GenCon US, so it may not be that you can play the role yourself, but maybe as Sprint's chair, you can help drum up some people who would. So at the Sprints 2019, after 2019 DjangoCon Europe, I tried to help new contributors who come along to Sprints get started. You know, get downloading Django, running the test suite, finding a ticket, this sort of thing. And I didn't have a collective way of doing that, so I did it sort of table by table, group by group, and I was just destroyed. I was blown out, and there were still people who were like twiddling their thumbs, didn't have anywhere to go, not anything to do. And so at Gen Con US we ran a workshop 2019, and it went really well. We had four tables, and we had some, but what I realized we had there, which I didn't really notice at the time, was like sort of veteran hands sort of placed in the audience, so to speak, on the tables helping. And like Smiley Chris was one of them, some other people, and they were working with the people, the genuine new contributors, going through, and you know, Smiley Chris obviously knows how to run the Django test suite. He's been around forever and a day, but because he was there, he was able to go through it, and it worked really well. And then I was able to get around the groups, having run it just in Porto this weekend. It went really well as well, but I was finding actually I was too many calls on my attention all at the same time. And there gets this, I have this line that if you look at a ticket, you become the world expert. So a new contributor always asks me, how is it that I can, as a new contributor, how can they have a voice in what the solution should be? And the answer is because if they investigate it, they, at that point when they've spent, you know, a couple of evenings and they've worked through it and they've really come up, they know more about that ticket at that moment than anyone else in the whole world. And so they, you know, they may not be the most experienced contributor, but the other contributors will listen to them because they know more. And that's how it becomes a conversation between the person working on it and, you know, everybody else who's in the Django community, rather than just, hey, you have to implement it this way, like the, you know, the senior dev told you what to do. It's not like that. And in the Sprint circumstance, because I'm busy trying to go around so many places, I can't load the individual ticket into my brain in order to have a meaningful conversation with them at the level they're at. They're far in front of me, and I haven't got the capacity at that moment to catch up. Whereas if there were, you know, a few senior, you know, more experienced developers, Django developers around in working through with them, those people would be able to go on the journey with them through the ticket and input meaningfully and help them get closer to a resolution in that day.
Exactly. And so in that kind of thing, you know, works very well at development sprints, and that's what, and so I think so part of the idea behind contributor mentor is to try to have that role happen offline, you know, and asynchronously, because I'm not sure that is a thing, or that we definitely have people who could fill that role, but perhaps some of them don't want to, or perhaps some of them aren't aware that, hey, like, this is a thing that needs to be done. Again, back to the idea of people who are contributing without code, you know, one of the values of recognizing those people is this, like, oh, you recognize, hey, the huge work that is being done that needs to be done, we didn't know it needed to be done because someone was just making it happen, and I didn't see it. I didn't know it. And so, in Porto, I spoke to people who were, you started to think about it from that standpoint. It's like, oh, you know, that's a thing I could do, but like I didn't really know that was a thing that was needed per se. Or maybe they're doing it like on a small scale, like with people that they know, with people that they work with, but sort of not realizing, oh, hey, this is a thing I could be doing. And that was one of the points of the talk, was to try to get that idea out there and to point out to people, hey, like, if you're making contributions, if you're making code contributions to Django, that's fantastic. Or, you know, or Python or whatever whatever project, that is fantastic, and we're thrilled that you're doing that. Consider perhaps being someone who helps other people make code contributions to your project of choice, so that the maintainers of your project of choice don't have to bear that burden themselves. You can help some of that. And the truth is, so people who were just in Porto with us, at the development sprint on day one, who made maybe like their first contribution or second code contribution, those people would be excellent code contributor mentors for people who are trying to make their first step, because they're familiar with the process, as well as people who have been making code contributions over a longer amount of time, but who also might have the mindset of, I would like to help people make code contributions. So I think that's important, but also, and I think this was sort of heavily impressed upon me just by being in Porto, we really, really need to change the way we talk about what it means to be a contributor, because there are all sorts of other problems that came up in me talking to people about my talk and about some of the language involved, as far as like, so there's an idea of like, you know, non-coding contributors being viewed a certain way, or there's a concept I introduced from Nadia Iqbal's book. I referenced Nadia Iqbal's book, Working in Public, that talks about how open source software is maintained, and there's a lot there. One of the issues that she talks about as far as the production side is this idea of what she calls a casual contributor, which is someone who, in the analogy she uses, like people who might like record like a tornado or some sort of news event on their phone and then send it to the local news station, and the news station uses that. Those people aren't planning to become reporters or cinematographers. You know, they're just there, they made that one contribution, and they're going to move on with their lives. You have casual contributors in the same way with code, with software projects. But each of those terms can sometimes make people feel sort of excluded, especially, you know, and I spoke to a couple people about this at PyCon Porter, and so this idea comes to me partially from those conversations. The idea that if you have sort of if you call someone a casual contributor or a non-coding contributor, it has the potential in some situations to diminish what they do, because they haven't taken on this full software engineering thing. I believe, I could be misremembering this, but I feel like you and I think we met at DjangoCon US 2018, and so one of the things I know that Will was, one of the things I remember Will talking about was the idea of making web development easier for people, you know, in general. And so, and the question of tooling around that, and I feel like you and I were both at lunch and, you know, talking about how that should be simpler, and someone at the table was like, well, but do we want those people in our community if they're not going to learn all these such and such tools? And I feel like you and I both in stereo answered, like, yes, because, like, you know, like, you shouldn't have to, you know, you shouldn't have to know Docker and Kubernetes and you know, Puppet and all this infrastructure's code tools to know web development. And so to bring that back to this idea of changing the way we talk about things, I feel like that's kind of the problem. I mean, the same underlying problem that causes people to be worried about being labeled as a code contributor or casual contributors or non-coding contributors is the same underlying problem that makes the DSF vice president go on stage and say he's never contributed to Django. So I feel like that's a thing that needs to be addressed. That sort of cultural thing needs to be addressed within our community, because there are so many different ways that people contribute, and they all need to be. And I don't say this in a like woo, let's, you know, everybody gets a participation trophy sort of way. I say this in a from the standpoint, again, as someone professionally trained in capitalism, like the salesperson or who, you know, whoever, you know, the people who contribute code, they are necessary, but without the entire rest of the team, the whole thing doesn't work. You know, I mean, like, as great as Michael Jordan was, he didn't win any championships by himself, you know. So.
Well, that's why, I mean, I was so pleased to see the most recent releases having more contributors and the steps Carlton's been taking to normalize this and recognize. I mean, I feel like it's only, I don't, how many years have I been inside of Django? I mean, 5, 6, like only now do I know all these people who do these things, but there isn't like a place where someone else could know about the event organizers, about all these things. So,
okay. So if contributor mentors are going to be contributors writ large, not, you know, just contributors, let's worry about the language we use, but let's have contributors in the large sense where it includes all contributors. One thing that a contributor mentor needs to have in mind is a kind of mental list of all the different jobs that get done. So at the beginning of the contributing guide, we've got writing code, translating, or writing documentation. But we haven't got all the other things.
Well, I think in my talk, I try to make a separation because I think it's valid, it's important. So code contributions and non-code contributions are two different things and require different sets of skills and different mindsets. And so, so for instance, when you point out the contributor guide, that's the contributor guide to the Django software project, to the specific actual code base of Django. But like the things, you know, the time and the DSF members, the DSF board members are doing that sort of thing, those are contributions to the larger Django project that don't involve code. And so there are different things there. And so I'm thinking of this idea of code contributor mentor and a non-code contributor mentor or some other language, as far as helping people make, having a class of people, these contributor mentors writ large, but some of the contributor mentors will focus on helping people make code contributions, and some of the people will focus on helping folks make non-code contributions. We talked about it before, so the code contributions are, for lack of a better term, easier, because it is easy to see sort of what needs to be done and what is done and how. The non-code contributions cover a much wider range of topics and a much more amorphous, but the help is needed on both sides, because again, in the same way we see and you hear about open source maintainers having burnout and that sort of thing, what the three of us know, because we have been involved in these different boards and things of that nature, is that people on the non-code contribution side burn out as well. You know, the DSF, PSF board members, conference organizers, things of that nature, those people are burning out as well. And so you're trying to make sure that, you know, help is there for them, or so that, you know, there's like a new generation of people being brought in to make those sorts of contributions or to solve these new problems. Because again, Django is 17, 18 years old now. There are issues that Django has to face now, that Python has to face now, that didn't exist 10 years ago, 20 years ago. And so new ideas are needed there. And that's where those people who are contributing without code and come from backgrounds other than software engineering can be super, super valuable. Because we need that, you know, we don't need just software engineers trying to solve all these problems. Because a lot of these problems, you know, they're organizational problems, they're financial problems, they're marketing problems, they have nothing to do with software engineering. And so a bunch of software engineers probably aren't the best people to solve them. So,
well, I think also the pandemic obviously has really hurt the new rejuvenation of members. I mean, you know, thinking of myself, I mean, how did I get roped in? I learned Django, I wrote about it, I gave a talk, and then it was at the conference and at local meetups where I got a sense of the community and then saw the needs. And, you know, that just hasn't been there with COVID. So there definitely is, on the non-code side, a number of people hanging on who I think are ready to move on and mentor people. But hopefully there will be from these conferences and other things, more people who want to come in and join and help out. So I think it's a little worse than it would normally be. It's still a challenge, but that's why it feels more acute. I mean, the board, right? We've had the same board the last Django Software Foundation board the last 2 years. There are multiple people who aren't going up for re-election, so there's a real chance there to have, you know, new blood and new ideas that will come up in the fall. but and all these other areas as well, translation and all the rest.
To have the conference in Porto this last week was just amazing. I came away thinking, oh yeah, we needed that. And that's, it was so good just to, you know, rebond with people and reconnect and meet new people, you know.
Well,
and
this podcast, Carlton, right? This podcast came out of DjangoCon because I met you and, you know, we had the idea like, hey, how do we replicate the hallway track? And here we are.
Let's do that.
Here we are, stuck with the podcast.
Okay. So you've mentioned Haim's keynote loads of times, Cody. I have one more question for you and Will, really. So Haim talks about at the end, he's like, well, so put your hands up if you're an individual member of the Django Software Foundation. So many people put your hands up. Put your hand up if you subscribe to the Django newsletter. So many people put your hands up. Put your hands up if you listen to the Django Chat podcast. So some more people put their hands up. But by perhaps half, that was only half the people in the room. And Haim's point was, well, the rest of you, I haven't got any channel which I can reach you via. Because we can talk about something on the podcast and Will and Jeff can put it in the newsletter and the mailing list for the individual members. But that's not the entirety of the Django community. So what might we do that would be a low maintenance, easy thing to do that... How might we have a channel which we can reach more?
Oh, good. I've got kind of a hot take that I've had for a while, but
yeah, go for it.
Let's have the hot take.
If you're hot, take the mic.
Right, so, I think for me, it comes back to sort of this new idea of how you talk about how we talk, but also just sort of how we behave as a community. And I'm sure. I guess at some point my talk also would become just one big talk. This idea of a lot of the Django or Python community's interaction with the rest of the world, a lot of that happens at the local level. At the local meetup level. And as Will pointed out, you know, here over the past couple of years, you know, a lot of those things have sort of gone away. Like, there are a number of local meetups, you know, that don't really meet anymore, or you know, they might have to be reconstituted or what have you. But like most people aren't and probably shouldn't, like most people who are using Python and Django aren't and probably shouldn't be interacting with the PSF and the DSF. It's like there's not necessarily like a reason, you know, for like if you've downloaded Django and you're building a site for, your town's volleyball league, like, you know, you don't necessarily need to talk to, you don't need to talk to anybody on the DSF board, you don't need that. But as far as what Hunt mentions about is, okay, how do I reach these other people? That sort of outreach and connection, I think, comes from the local meetup. So, like, I know, like, I have attended all these various things because I went to my local Python meetup here in Houston. Okay, there's more to be done upstairs. I went to my local Python meetup and met various people, and, you know, they had certain attitudes as far as how people use Python and use Django and contribute, that sort of thing. And I know in other cities and in other places, it's that same thing. So the initial thing is, like, we need to change kind of how we talk about this and stop having our culture be so software engineering centric. And so, like, even within people who write code professionally, I have seen, like, in my own local Python meetup, as the shift happened towards, like, web development so we had a Python meetup in Houston. It split into a Python and a Django meetup because as Django became more popular, there are lots of people who use Python for non-web stuff and didn't want to sit through a bunch of, you know, Django talks. And so we had two different meetups. But then even within just the straight Python meetup, there was a sort of a split between people who were sort of following newer, you know, developing software engineering trends like Docker and containerization and things of that nature. And then there were other people who were like, well, I've been writing Python since like 1998 and I've never needed to use Docker once. So, like, who are these people who are going to tell me that this is the way? So there's definitely a lot of sort of leaning in one particular direction. So I think that needs to change because I think that's how word gets back. Word from DjangoCon Europe and from DjangoCon US the people who attend that then go home to their local meetups. They go back to the Munich Python meetup and to the London Python meetup and to, you know, the, you know, what, Lawrence, Kansas doesn't have, I guess RevSys is the Lawrence, Kansas Python meetup, you know, to the Houston Python meetup, and they share those ideas with their people. So that's kind of how, you know, that's sort of the diffusion approach. But the really hot part of the take is we need to stop being jerks, and we need to normalize not being jerks. Like just because somebody's not a professional software engineer doesn't mean they can't be part of our community, and we have to get past that. There's a certain amount of hero worship that comes up. People who are sort of enamored of the very heavy software engineering approach, and not recognizing that you can use Python and Django to solve a wide range of real world problems without having to use all the software engineering tooling. And so I think that's just part of it, just sort of changing the way we talk about this stuff, and that makes its way back out to the broader community. But I think also just sort of recognizing that, like, there are a whole bunch of people who can use Django and benefit from it and don't need to, you know, Han doesn't need to talk to them, and they don't need to hear from him. Because, like, if you didn't, you know, as long as I can download Django and it works and it does what I need it to do, like, you know, thank you, mysterious Django people, you know, for making me the software.
Exactly. Or Will, Django's free. Why aren't your books free, Will? I love that one. But there is this guild mentality that some people have around, you know, well, I have a CS degree and it should be hard, and, you know, it's a big world. I mean, honestly, when I hear people getting on a high horse about something, as it's just insecurity, personally. I mean, if you meet...
Or gatekeeping.
Yeah, or gatekeeping. I mean, it's, you know, so you take it for what it is, but it doesn't have to be that way. It shouldn't be that way. It doesn't need to be that way. At the same time, there is that, you know, just like in organizations, there's the individual contributor to manager leap. Not everyone who tackles tickets wants to be a mentor. That's fine, right? It's a different personality. It's a different thing.
But when we talk about sort of, when I'm talking about community culture, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's something that gets missed, is that there are people who have a personality such that they want to be mentors and they would like to be mentors and like to be encouraging people. But the example that is, you know, I'm the black guy, so I'm just going to have to go there. So, like, we have seen over the past month or so people in an uproar about the Little Mermaid, the new Little Mermaid being black, and there being black elves in Lord of the Rings, and people, you know, non-black people seem to be mad about that. Sorry, not sorry. So you talk about sometimes issues of representation, and when we look at within just our software communities, what is seen is, again, the culture being heavily biased towards software engineering, but then also being heavily biased towards this individual genius contributor sort of thing. And that's kind of, that's what people coming into the community kind of think they need to be aspiring to. And the reality is, there's plenty of need for you to show up and be someone who is kind and friendly and nurturing and supportive as a software engineer. Like, so you could be a software engineer who is kind and friendly and supportive and mentors other software engineers to do software engineering stuff, or you could be someone who makes code contributions. Perhaps you're not intending to be, you know, have a career as a software engineer, but you can, if you have the mindset and the personality of someone who wants to help other people and be kind and supportive and help other people grow and help yourself grow in the process, then you could become, you know, you could try to work towards becoming a code contribution mentor and help other people do that sort of thing. But I don't know that we're seeing these examples of, you know, kind, helpful, supportive people in our coding communities. We're not seeing those examples. We're seeing, like, the individual lone genius, you know, I'm antisocial and I don't like to talk to people because I'm too smart for that, because I'm doing wiki code things that, you know, normal mortals wouldn't understand. This sort of, like, the angry Unix wizard, you know, archetype that we had that existed, like, in the 70s and the 80s or what have you. It seems like that's sort of got pushed forward into this sort of lone genius developer mindset. But the reality is, like there is no lone genius in Python or Django. Like, there was just, like, this one really smart person who just, you know, made all of Python or Django by themselves and continues to do that.
Right. If they were a jerk, they wouldn't have had people help them out. I mean,
exactly.
Django was built on collaboration. It was. It was.
Well, Well, Django especially, but I mean, even...
I'm just thinking about what you're saying, Kojo. I'm thinking...
Even CPython, you know, it's built on the power of friendship. I mean, that's kind of what it is. I mean, it's people helping each other, you know, do a very complicated thing, build this very large, complicated software that's used by billions of people all over the world, and it's not just this one lone genius thing. But we don't see that part. We, you know, what we see is what sort of gets pushed, sort of the community culture and the community narrative that gets pushed. And some of it is also is definitely a side effect of U.S. culture, I can say. But even like sort of within our group specifically, there's so much emphasis on, like, you know, being a brilliant developer or a 10x developer. Fortunately, people don't say that anymore, I don't think. But, you know, like being a 10x developer or a code ninja or, you know, whatever. But the reality is, if you want to be friendly and kind and supportive to people in a software engineering community, you can do that. Or in a programming community, just using Python and Django to solve tools, that is a valid approach to take.
Yeah. Well, attitude over aptitude every day of the week, assuming there's a base aptitude. And even I, because most of my friends aren't programmers, programming, I think, is unusual in that it's sort of a hive mind that you have. It's very intimate when you're seeing someone else's code. Most white-collar professions, you hire someone, it's like, you got the credential, go sit in an office, deal with patients. Oh, you're a little bit of a jerk. I don't have to deal with that. But coding, if you have a jerk, you know, if you have a bad apple in the mix, it's going to pollute everything. It's so much more about communication, I would say, than many other fields where you can just kind of be solo, get a credential, and do it. You know, you have to collaborate so much more. So anyone who's a bad apple, I mean, I think of some of the people when I was at a startup and had to fire, it was probably the most brilliant programmer, but he wasn't good to work with. And we were going around and saying, hey, this new thing, who wants to work with him on it? And the entire group, no one raised their hand. And we're like, okay, well, you know,
that's not going to work. Though.
That's not going to work. You know, so I don't know. I hear what you're saying. I don't get that same sense, but I'm not on Twitter as much. I hope it's not still that case, or I hope I can see how new people might feel that, you know, it's Linus or all these people, but even someone like John Carmack, like he's not necessarily a jerk. Like he's pretty, you know, so I hope that goes away.
So John Carmack definitely,
younger, maybe as younger he was. Now he's mellowed out, maybe, perhaps.
Yeah, and so what I've seen in Carmack, you know, I haven't seen him sort of being a jerk, but I feel like in a lot of ways he has been less visible than, say, Elinus Torvalds or other people like that, from the standpoint of, like, people know who he is and what he's done, but he wasn't necessarily, like, the face of a major project for an extended period of time. It seems like he was fine just sort of doing what he did and living his life. So things have definitely changed as far as, you know, how we interact with the community. Again, the pandemic has changed so many different things, and I think we are continuing to figure out what those things are and how to adapt to them. But I feel like a lot of it comes down to us as members of a community working to ensure that our community culture is positive. I think it was Kaplan-Moss who said it, maybe? That's where I heard it from. This sort of idea that any community culture that's not sort of tended or maintained tends towards toxicity. And I feel like we might have gone a little too long without, you know, without a little more tending, or maybe overlooking an area of community culture that needed to be tended or maintained. This idea that, okay, you know, we can't have everything be so heavily slanted towards software engineering as the one true way to use Python or Django. And also, hey, you know what? Like, people can be kind and collaborative in all sorts of ways. Like you don't have to just, like, if you want to be kind and collaborative with Python or Django, you don't have to just limit it to, like, PyLaters or Django girls or to some sort of a community service thing. Like, you can be kind and collaborative while helping people work on tickets in Django, or while helping people work on tickets in CPython, or while helping people figure out how to secure new funding for the PSF or for the DSF so that we can continue to have a developer in residence, or we can continue to have Django fellows. Like, you know, you can be kind and collaborative in all those different ways within our community, because that's how we roll and that's what we do.
Well, Carlton, at my first talk where we met, beyond being the Django fellow, was kind enough to, after the talk, mention that I misspoke on something rather than raise his hand and ask me publicly about it. So I remember that was one of my first thoughts on Carlton. I was like, that was very kind of him. I mean, I would have been fine if you called it out, but...
No, hombre. Just give him a talk. Excuse me, I've got a comment. It's more a comment than a question.
Did you know that you're wrong, or are you just an idiot? Yeah.
No. That's horrible when that happens. Kojo, we've probably gone over, but super. Thank you for joining us straight after your long flight, and you can go and relax. But it, such a good important topic that we were desperate to have you on and kick off the new season with chatting about.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you all, just sort of in general, but also just good to sort of talk to Carlton after having just seen him recently in person, and like I'll see him in a few weeks.
I'm giving a talk as well.
Okay, so it'll be good to I just saw Carlton a few days ago, but it's been a long time since I've seen Will, so it'd be good to see you all here in person.
We should say that's DjangoCon US in San Diego. What are the dates? Because I think there's just a few tickets available if people still rush.
Yes, they're still online. It is the 16th to the 21st of October. With the talks are so tutorials on the 16th, talks 17th through 19th, and sprints 20th and 21st. And you can get hybrid. You can get online hybrid tickets if you can't attend.
It's a hybrid event this year, so I point out to people at DjangoCon Europe, like, it'd be nice for them to come, but I also realize it's a little late, a month before the event to try to plan a trip from Europe to NORAM. But yes, they're also it's a hybrid event, so there are online tickets available. So that is always a thing. I have different dates in my head because I'm arriving. I'm moving back forth at different times. So as a conference organizer, and then as a Rush employee, I'm moving at different things. So
yeah, different dates. So thank you, Kojo. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We are DjangoChat.com, ChatDjango on Twitter, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.